Welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Suhey Vega, author of Latino Heartland, of Borders and Belonging in the Midwest, published by New York University Press in 2015. Dr. Vega is trained as an anthropologist and holds the position of Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies in the School of Social Transformation at Arizona State University, where she also holds an affiliate faculty position in the School of Transborder Studies. Her research and teaching interests include race and ethnic studies, social networks, gendered experiences, and ethno-religious practices. In particular, her research explores the everyday lived experiences of Latinos by tracing how they fashion home, community, and belonging in the United States. Hello, Suhey, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm excited for this.
Wonderful. I was hoping you could begin our discussion today by telling us a little bit about your personal and professional background.
Sure. Well, let's see. I'm a daughter of once undocumented immigrants, and so I think that's definitely important, and it's something I speak about in the book. Mm-hmm. Both my parents are from Mexico, and they both overstayed their visas, like many undocumented immigrants do sometimes. And I was born in this country, and both, you know, working class parents. My father worked, my mother stayed home, but it was very much a working class experience. I was the first in my family to get an advanced degree, and obviously college was not familiar to my my older family, and I kind of had to navigate that world on my own, especially when it came to graduate school. I had an older sibling who went to college, but did not get an advanced degree. So this whole world of academia is definitely new. So when I was, that history is important, obviously, because right. I do work on Latinos in the U.S. In a sense, I'm almost trying to retrace the experience of my own family and give voice to the people that are living the lives that, like, my family was living.
Mm-hmm. So definitely this project is very close to home. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, I know you did your undergraduate work in Texas. Is that where you grew up, or did you grow up somewhere else?
Yeah, so I grew up in San Fernando, California. I was born and raised in San Fernando. My parents, my dad, obviously in the 90s, there was, you know, issues with employment, as many communities across the nation experienced. So he was transferred to a small suburb in Texas. And really, I was about 14 at the time when we moved, and that was my first real experience with a non-Latino community. San Fernando, for those familiar, it's very much a Latino ethnic community and enclave in the valley.
Right.
And moving to Texas was the first time I really kind of engaged going to school with and living amongst people that weren't Latino.
Right, right. Yeah, I bet that would be a big shift. I mean, from greater Los Angeles, the San Fernando Valley, to Texas, and particularly, I guess, so this was more of, I mean, this is more of an Anglo portion of Texas, right? I mean, there's yes. plenty of portions that could be very, you know, strongly Latino.
Right.
So this
was
quite a shock.
A suburb. Yeah. This is a suburb in between Dallas and Fort Worth, Arlington. And, you know, for those that know Arlington's actually pretty ethnically diverse, large Vietnamese population as well as Latino, but still white majority. And so,
right.
yeah, that was... culture shock for
gotcha.
Me.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And then so you did your undergraduate work in Texas, and then your graduate work was the University of Illinois. Is that right?
That's correct. So I was a McNair student, obviously, because I did
Great.
Not have a prior experience with higher education. And because I was a McNair student, I had the opportunity the summer before my senior year to take a tour of schools that were in the area. And I decided to do kind of a driving tour of the Midwest and apply for programs there because some of the, you know, greatest anthropology programs are in the Midwest.
Right.
So in doing this tour of the Midwest as a young Chicana from California and Texas, I came across Iowa and Illinois and the rural Midwest, and I found that there were Latinos living there, and it shocked me. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And being, I don't know, the young anthropologist that I was at the time, you know, we went into a burrito shop in Iowa City, right across the street from campus, And I heard Spanish, and I was shocked. And so I asked the guy behind the counter, I'm like, what are you guys doing here? And they're like, we live here. And they've been living there for a long time. And they even said, you'd be shocked how many Mexicanos are in Iowa.
Exactly.
And so I guess that was the first time where I thought, gosh, I'm so upset that I didn't know this.
Right, right.
And so that was kind of my first entree into looking at Latinos in the Midwest.
Right, and indeed, that's part of what the book you know, seeks to do. Right, is overturn that the initial presumption that Latinos are primarily located in the Southwest, maybe primarily urban populations, but that there's actually been a longer history of Latinos that that actually live in the country's heartland, particularly rural America. So will you talk a little bit about that, about how this project evolved, this was your introduction to it, this initial kind of shocking experience that there were Latinos in this rural middle America. Tell us a little bit more about, how you'll go from there to writing a book.
Right. So my master's thesis was on Chicago Little Village Pilsen area community, very historically present, very well known in Latino studies as a large Mexicano population in particular. But I was living in Champaign-Urbana, I saw that there was other pockets, obviously, of communities. There's a community in Kankakee, which is a small rural, well, not so small anymore, but a rural town between Urbana, Champaign, and Chicago. I found out about this community in Indiana because at the time my partner, now my husband, was going to school at Purdue. And I would visit often. You know, we do the whole long-distance relationship thing. He'd come over to see me, I'd see him. And when I was visiting him, I would notice panaderias and Mexican grocery stores. And now going back to my past in Arlington in Texas, these are things that were rare in Texas. I mean, we could find a panaderia, but you had to go find it and search for it. They weren't right immediately in the vicinity. And this town in Indiana was small, and I was, I guess, taken aback by the fact that there was access to a panaderia, access to e-grocery stores, and obviously Mexican restaurants. I thought that was interesting in terms of space and looking at, you know, their presence, their obvious presence in physical spaces.
Right.
Again, given my interest in Latinos in the Midwest and looking at these other non-traditional populations, I wanted to expand our knowledge of the Midwest as not just a Chicago-based experience.
Right.
And looking at these other communities, mostly because I also realized that it's not just the Midwest or the Nuevo South, as is known now, but the 21st century Latinos are moving into these quote-unquote non-traditional settling locations. Mm-hmm. They're going into suburbs. They're going into rural areas. Even in California, they're going into rural parts of California that they might not have necessarily existed in a majority beforehand.
Right.
And so I wanted to expand our notion of Latino communities, not outside of the Southwest, even outside of the urban experience, as in Chicago, to look at these other communities. And then once I started researching in Indiana, I realized that this community had been there since the 60s, which is, you know, pretty substantial in terms of understanding that it's not really a new community. And I thought, well, there's plenty more out there, I'm sure, too. So I wanted to contribute to that conversation and say we need to expand our notions of Latinos in the U.S. to these other existing communities.
Right. And by your realization that it wasn't a new community, you mean that there's, you know, now multiple generations of Latinos living in these spaces, right?
Yeah.
So even though maybe to, you know, those that look at history, I mean, typically when I tell people I study 20th century history, some are blown away and think, oh, really? That's a thing? Like, I mean, when they think history, they're thinking centuries ago, millennia ago, and it's okay. But so as far as a long established history, we're talking about multiple generations of families living and raising, building community in these places that are predominantly thought of as white, right? English.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then on top of that, so the book is called Latino Heartland, even though it's got a majority Mexicano population, because that was the historical presence. And so you have Mexicanos coming in the late 50s, early 60s, and establishing themselves. And now, as I mentioned in the book, there's, you know, their great-great-grandchildren, so fourth generation, are growing up in this town. But along with it being a quote-unquote new population or non-traditional settling, you have other Latino communities coming. So you have El Salvadorians and Puerto Ricanos exactly. who are arriving as well. And to me, that also made a very interesting dynamic, right? And so that traditionally towns, especially in the Southwest, when you look at Mexicanos, are Mexican majority.
Right.
And here in other quote-unquote new spaces, you have interactions with the other Latino communities. And that might make for a very different experience than, let's say, in San Fernando, where I grew up.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little about what I found interesting is in the preface, you discuss how, you know, typically we think of migration as something that's predominantly economically driven, and it really is. But these people, and a lot of the people that you end up speaking with, they actually, you know, chose to move to, you know, small town, you know, Lafayette, because they saw it as more advantageous to the other urban experiences they had already had. So
yeah,
it's not
totally.
Even as if, you know, Latinos are just, although some did migrate directly to perhaps Lafayette, there's a process of internal migration, right? Once Latinos are already here to where, you know, they're following jobs and moving and finding new places and making decisions based upon what's best for both themselves and their families. And for a number of them, they come to see Lafayette as quite advantageous over, you know, Los Angeles or other, you know, or Chicago or other urban centers. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, so not surprisingly, the 1990s factor is a large moment where you have migration happening across the country. And when you look at places like the Midwest, the rural Midwest, or the Nuevo South, as the new term is coming up, you know, the 90s we see is a big uptake in Latino migration to these spaces.
Right.
And what I discuss in the book is, like, this is definitely related to issues of competition and economics in the Southwest, as well as immigration politics. And so you have Prop 187 in California, you mm-hmm. have Prop 200 in Arizona, as well as an economic downturn. And so competition's huge. Families are really trying to figure out what's best for them in terms of their economic basis, but also their safety, their overall living conditions, and sometimes having a network that says you should try coming out here. It's better. You know, what's the cost of living is
right.
better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your children will have an opportunity in a way that they may not otherwise. And so that was driving a lot of folks coming to, at least Indiana. And from personal experience, even to Nebraska, I have some cousins that were in Pacoima, which is a pretty you know, it's not urban, it's part of the San Fernando Valley, but, mm-hmm. you know, they lived in Pacoima, lived in an older home, struggled to keep the rent, or they were their mortgage, and realized that they actually could make a better living for themselves in Nebraska. And so
right.
my tios and cousins are in Nebraska now. And so you have a lot of this happening in the 90s, people having to negotiate and kind of navigate and balance, you know, where do we stay? Do we stay where we're familiar, where we have an established network like LA or Chicago, or do we try make it out to these other spaces where we might have more economic opportunities because the job competition isn't as big, but more so more chances for our families to develop, for our kids to have a good time. One of the families was talking about how LA is puro freeways or all freeways, right.
right?
It's all about concrete jungle in the sense that there's really nothing to do. You're just always working and you're going home and you're not really enjoying, you know, life. And so
right.
people left, went to Indiana, went to other parts and found that they now had a much better experience in terms of having a weekend
right.
and enjoying the fruits of their labor in a way that they may not have been able to do in the past because of higher cost of living and, you know, just situations with regards to their safety and their children. Many of them discussed gangs
mm-hmm.
and even drug problems in some of their urban centers that they were living at, and they didn't want that for their children.
Right. And for some of them, so there's this confluence of both market and lifestyle, right, options, decisions that are prompting this move, right, and these decisions to settle in these maybe, you know, non-traditional, non-typical Latino spaces. And also, I think you mentioned that some even related to, you know, rural, you know, middle America as more familiar, you know, from, you know, the home that was left in Mexico or other, you know, sending regions. Is that right?
Yes, so that was most fascinating for me is when I talked to people. You know, I was initially wanting to do space analysis. I wanted to look at geography and, you know, how does space matter? How are people rejuvenating old, you know, rust belts, Midwest, you know, in terms of opening grocery stores and businesses and et cetera. And so I asked them about the space that they were living at. What do they think about the spaces that they're in? And some folks mentioned the rivers, the naturaleza, the natural landscapes, is familiar to their rural experiences in Mexico in a way that the urban, again, this kind of concrete jungle experience was not. And so from a rural Mexico perspective, if the migrants were coming out of rural Mexico and then going into urban spaces in the U.S., that was a culture shift just from the rural to the urban.
Right.
And moving then to these small cities in Indiana and Lafayette became a more familiar, like, not laid back, but in a sense, kind of like natural landscapes. You had trees, you had natural parks, and then obviously you had the time to go to them in a way that you didn't before in California.
Right, right.
So all those things, you know, it was a familiar landscape for them, which was shocking to me because I think of snow and, you know, inches of ice on the road when I think of the Midwest, but they kind of, in their mind, you know, were able to face the other aspects of the natural landscapes in a positive way too.
Right, right. Well, and that's fascinating to me too, because it's you know, also it's to me there's always risk involved in migration, but something particular that I calculate, even, you know, in my very small migrations, my personal migration with my family, between more of my wife and my children, our decisions of when we were applying to graduate school, now that we're applying for other opportunities and things like that, where would we go? Where are we going to settle? And a lot of the conversation always is, what's the demographic? What's the community? You know, it is the basics of, can we find a panaderia, right? Can we find the right kind of tortillas? I mean, things like that.
Right.
I mean, real decisions, real issues for us as we think of contemplating maybe someday, right, moving out of the Southwest. I am there, but, you know, therefore amazed. And that's what this book is about, right? How these people then, right, they have all these other factors that structure this decision to moving to a non-traditional, right, predominantly non-Latino area, and how they then remake that place, right? How they make that place into home. And that's what this book is about, right?
Yeah, well, and it's quality of life. It really is. It's trying to find a better quality of life and then making the spaces that you are living in, you know, by accident or, you know, by intention, making them feel better, like making you feel at home.
Right.
And so, yeah, the book talks about how there was one mom who, you know, she, her family stayed, and other people did leave, by the way, right at the beginning when they arrived. They're like, oh, no, this is not a space for me. This is entirely too different from what I know. There's not any Spanish-speaking community here. I'm gone. Some of those individuals actually came back years later because they realized it had grown. But a mom was saying that she would have to make her kids' piñatas because they didn't have any options.
Right, right.
Tortillas were even hard to come by. Carnes, you know, meat cuts specifically were hard to find. And so people would make runs to Chicago and, you know, ask the neighbors or their family, do you need anything? And they would bring back, like, ice chests full of different meats and tortillas.
Right. And
so that initially was difficult, for sure, but it developed into then, you know, one entrepreneur saying, well, let me open up my own grocery store. And it was tiny, and then it just started spreading from there. Other folks decided, why not? And you had other businesses grow, and that made it so that when folks arrived in the 90s, it was a lot more, there were more conveniences of home than there would have been in the 60s and the 70s.
Right. And what you're talking about right now really gets at what's at the heart of the book, which is you know, this concept of ethnic belonging, which you speak about in the beginning of the book, and then also you have two specific chapters that focus on it, where it's this kind of these everyday like lived experiences of building community, interrelating with people in you know, various social situations, non-political predominantly, but, you know, social in, you know, either religious institutions or just in neighborhoods, like, as you just mentioned, right? I'm running to Chicago, right? to get some stuff, right? And what do you need, right? And that these types of interactions build that sense of ethnic belonging that later transforms to, you know, other, in what way, can be politics, can be, you know, types of mobilizations, other maybe more formal aspects of building or asserting community, appropriating space. Because essentially this book really, you know, revolves around a very politicized issue, right? The 2006 mobilizations against the Sensenbrenner Bill, H.R. 4437, right? I think was the official tag of that bill. And since then, we've had a number of our other, you know, big immigration debate issues. But that was kind of, that's the big event that this book kind of, I think, maybe begins with and builds back from and then goes forward from, right? So you, is that kind of correct?
Yes. And so, interesting about the Sensenbrenner bill. So I say mentioned this in the book. Senator Sensenbrenner is from Wisconsin. So what I note is that, you know, this is obviously not the first time that the country deals with immigration and within the notion of Latinos in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the first time that we deal with it, but it becomes one of the first times that the Midwest is playing a major part in this, right? Or
right.
Non-traditional locations are playing a major part because it was a senator from Wisconsin that introduces the bill, and he's tied to it forever, the Sensenbrenner bill. And what we see as a result, obviously, not just is anti-immigrant rhetoric from politicians that unfortunately we see even today with the presidential candidates and in more local debates and state-based legislation, but we see a counter-response, okay? So you have the political rhetoric that's very anti-immigrant, and then you have what many were surprised by, which is the Latino manifestations of civic activism going on in cities throughout the country. You know, so you had demonstrations and marches, Chicago being the first one, and then L.A. for sure. Then you had them in Texas, even here in Arizona, and throughout, certainly, the U.S., and people were shocked that this was happening, that Latinos were taking part and really active and trying to move the debate towards more responsible, compassionate reform rather than this antagonistic, draconian laws that, unfortunately, we still have today. So that becomes a catalyst into looking at this moment because I noticed that people were participating. Indianapolis was a large march that often gets taken off the table because people just assume it's in Chicago, this march. But Indianapolis becomes a large place where many Latinos who lived in Indiana or even in other parts of the Midwest who may not have been able to go to Chicago formed and organized their Indianapolis rally. And I guess one of the questions I was thinking about as this was all happening while I was quote-unquote collecting data, right, when I was doing field research and interviewing, is I was wondering how did this, like, how are people coordinating? How are people who otherwise aren't running for office or very civically active, how are they coordinating for this event? And then what happens when those things, you know, the march ends? What happens when people go home? And how does, what does their activism still look like? And what I argue is that, you know, you don't have to necessarily be civically active every day to still participate in your community.
Exactly.
And so what I'm saying is ethnic belonging is the basis by which people start seeing themselves as belonging to a community, being willing to fight for that belonging, but also not being assimilated into the larger community by saying, I'm actually ethnic and I also belong.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the book begins with this more of a historical look, right? You're in a way, it is perplexing to wonder, right, how this bill, which I love reading the whole title of the bill because it's just, you know, I think it just speaks to the kind of irony of it, right? So the Sensenbrenner's bill, H.R. 4437, was the Border Protection, Anti-Terrorism, and Illegal Immigration Control Act of 2005, right? So that's what kind of sparks this, right? So you're interested then in looking at a couple of things, right? The formation of community by Latinos in this white space, but then also, right, how does this bill come out of this rural space that is so predominantly white, right? And so chapter one then looks at, you know, it takes like a historical look of central Indiana and the role of mythology, history, mythology, and migration, right, to the region. And in particular, I love the term that you use here, this phrase, you know, this, the palimpsest of history, Right, so this kind of layering of histories that shaped notions of belonging, both within the nation and then within, you know, this regional area and local community, that kind of conditioned the response, right, to both the migration of Latinos and then the kind of fury or flurry of anti-immigrant rhetoric that rose up both within this community and then as a nation as a whole, right? So can you talk a little bit about that, about the history of Central Indiana and the predominantly, you know, what's the predominant narrative history and mythologies that have allowed people to imagine that community a particular way?
Right. So what's important is that the letters, so one of the things I do in one of the chapters is like kind of call to task the letters to the editor and the different political rhetoric happening, both from politicians but also from local individuals who wanted to portray a certain image of Indiana that was absent of Latino contributions.
Mm-hmm.
And so the letters of the editors themselves are hitting on history. So they often will write something like, my parents came the legal way, or my immigrant ancestors assimilated, why can't they? And so I started looking at that history, and I should say that I was trained as a historian as an undergraduate as well, so I'm partial to history
mm-hmm.
and critiquing it. And so when these letters started saying, you know, my grandparents came the right way, blah, 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 I'm like, well, let's look into that. What did their grandparents do?
Mm-hmm.
What was the way that they came? And looking at Indiana in particular, so Indiana forms part of what's called the German Triangle in early European immigrant history to the U.S., where there was a large population of German immigrants coming to the U.S. in the mid-19th century into the early 20th century. And this was a very ethnically German population. And, you know, again, there was subtle things throughout the research. The current Latino Spanish services for Catholics is in the same church that was German founded, you know, again, back in the 1800s, in the mid-1800s. And so I saw the layerings of the past and how did the German immigrants experience their life there, and how does that relate to Latinos today, especially when some of the very descendants of those German immigrants are the ones that are casting out the Latinos, right?
Right.
When had they known their history, they would have seen that their own immigrant ancestors went through the exact same thing.
Exactly.
And, you know, what would they have thought of the way that their grandchildren are acting towards these new immigrants?
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, there is the KKK history of Indiana. I mean, we can't forget that there was a resurgence of the KKK in the 1920s, primarily through political means, to take over the state of Indiana and definitely use xenophobia to that realm. And then you have the fact that Indiana was a quote-unquote free state in terms of its black residents and how, you know, it considers itself as progressive free state, but in fact, in practice, it wasn't necessarily very pro-black in terms of residents' acceptance.
Right.
And then the initial history I start off, one of the histories that I start off with is looking at the Native American experience and settler
mm-hmm.
colonialism.
Right.
Especially when letters to the editor would say, you know, we came the right way and this was our land. And I'm like, well, really, was it?
Right.
And looking at the other histories of settler colonialism, and really kind of unpacking the way that the past is remembered and misremembered
mm-hmm.
And how that misremembering then allows people to casually forget and then negatively see Latinos who are arriving.
Right. Yeah, you refer to this as a pathology of forgetting, right? This privileging
yeah.
and reimagining of a white German past and one that was particularly assimilative, right? And
yeah.
that's the rewriting of the history, right? Because it
right.
these communities weren't assimilative. They
no.
are very ethnic, forming ethnic schools, right? Religious institutions
yeah.
where in
oh,
their
yeah.
language predominated, right?
One of my favorite stories comes from the German families, from that very church, by the way, that also now houses the Latino population, the Catholic Church,
mm-hmm.
who at some point they had new teachers coming in, and the German families, German parents, wrote the Mother Superior and basically slammed her for sending non-German-speaking teachers and saying, this is not happening again.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to send us German speakers. And I guess as a Catholic myself, right, I know what that means to stand up to somebody like the Mother Superior and
mm-hmm.
say, this is not happening.
Right.
And so they were very active in maintaining ethnic identity. Now, unfortunately, right, they went through the hysteria from the World War I
exactly.
that slap down their experiences, but more reason for than German Americans now to not do the same thing to Latinos.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. And so then chapters, I'm going to skip chapter two, because I'm going to include that with our discussion of chapter five, and where we really start talking about how Latinos created their sense of ethnic belonging. And I want to cover chapter three and four, because it fits really, you know, into this discussion of the rewriting and reimagining of history. And that is, can we talk a bit about the discourses that began to emerge, you know, in 2005, 2006, as, you know, the Sensenbrenner bill is being discussed in the media. You discuss this as there's a process of othering and racialization that starts to really gain a lot of tread. Again, both this is happening across the nation, but we're looking specifically here in central Indiana. So can you talk about how that kind of process worked? Like where were these narratives being formed? Right. Who was doing this? And
kind of, well, you see it from both. And what I talk about is this is like the lived impact of political rhetoric. And so mm-hmm. you see it from a national perspective. You see national individuals, Sensenbrenner being one of them, but he wasn't the only one, obviously. You had national figures talking and creating this image of Latinos and undocumented immigrants in a negative way. And then you have local politicians, because that was also an election year. And so the local politicians certainly took it on as their thing. And then you had all that trickle down then to ways people actually talked about Latinos in their neighborhood. And here I'm not talking about undocumented immigrants.
Right.
I'm talking about the way that they translated the negative images of undocumented immigrants to all Latinos.
Right.
So what I say in the book is that even though people kept saying, oh, this is not about race, this is about legal. And, you know, what part of legal don't you understand?
Right.
Except for when you look at the actual rhetoric and the discourse, you see that there's a lot of slippage, right? And so when people start talking about language use, when they start talking about living in the neighborhood, they are not talking about the legal. They have no clue. You know, somebody mm-hmm. can speak Spanish, and that doesn't mean they're automatically undocumented.
Mm-hmm.
But so there was slippage in the rhetoric from the letters to the editor and even some of the politicians that though they would say this is about the legal immigration issue and the quote-unquote illegal immigration issue, their references were often race and ethnic based. And so their actual examples were not dealing with the legal aspect. They were dealing with somebody's ethnic, racial, cultural makeup.
Right.
And that's where I said that's the big problem, is that they easily slipped into race-based arguments.
Right.
But they would never acknowledge that, of course.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So the discourses of, you know, anti-immigration, legality, nativism, these things became, you know, transported or put onto Latino bodies, right? Latino bodies became marked as just by any type of ethnic marker that can be perceived as Latino, or again, be that language or any type of phenotypical look or cultural practice.
Right.
Those people came to be labeled as part of this group, right?
It goes back to early social science work on the problem, the Mexican problem. So, you know, early 20th century, you right. have Manuel Gamio researching the Mexican problem to look at, you know, what's the problem with Mexicanos in the U.S. This is 1920s mm-hmm. and 1930s. Now, what happened then in 2006 and is happening still, I argue, is that you have folks say the problem is, quote-unquote, illegal immigration, and yet they see problems with anyone that's dark-skinned, speaks Spanish, ethnically presents themselves as Latino. Those things have nothing to do with legal immigration.
Mm-hmm.
But they get raced as the problem. So anybody that spoke Spanish in public, anybody that just looked, quote-unquote, Hispanic, whatever that means, was then branded as a problem
mm-hmm.
in the larger notions of problems with the U.S. And so, and then you mentioned the name of SB 1070, I'm sorry, 4437,
mm-hmm.
And how it becomes an anti-terrorist bill.
Right.
And so obviously then all these things kind of congeal in a post 9/11 world so that anybody that can be identified as quote unquote illegal, given these racial markers, and ethnic linguistic markers, becomes race negatively as a problem
right.
in society.
And the Sensenbrenner bill is really, I think, the first piece of national legislation that I can think of, right, that really sought to really establish this connection between an actual, you know, national security threat with the U.S.-Mexico border, right? I mean, this is only a few years after 9/11, of course.
Right.
And so it's both interesting, with, you know, so ironic that, you know, within a bill that predominantly targets the stripping of rights and privileges, you know, from ethnic Mexican migrants, that it is labeled, you know, something that has to do with anti-terrorism and right. national security. But it's really just, again, it's really just about making life really difficult for people that are migrating from Mexico to fill, you know, jobs that they're being recruited for, quite frankly, right? So anyways, I mean, I just found that as an interesting
corollary. No, it's true. I mean, it was a convenient ploy to use the terrorism, the moment of anti-terrorism legislation to use this, right? So that even though, right, I do this with my students all the time, when we talk about 9/11 as the moment that changes the way the U.S. sees its borders, although it really doesn't, it just kind of emphasizes it more. Mm-hmm. But terrorism, for sure, you talk about where the bombers came from, and many of them crossed the Canadian border,
mm-hmm.
except for in the legislation, you would think they crossed the Mexican border because that's
exactly.
the border that's vigilant. Yes. And so that goes back to familiar tropes
exactly.
of a Mexican problem. And so mm-hmm. this is just another way to blame somebody that we're already familiar with blaming.
Mm-hmm. And the other interesting fact, of course, is that these pieces of you know, anti-immigrant legislation in my study as well, I've looked at this both from, you know, California and the, you know, the 1990s and early 2000s with this flood of own, you know, restrictionist immigration type measures, as well as, you know, things like the Sensenbrenner bill, is that they typically always fall on, you know, build up to election years, whether we're talking about, mm-hmm. you know, you know, whether it's a national presidential election like now, right? All of a sudden, what's the first issue that comes to the fore,
yeah.
thanks to Trump,
yeah.
is anti-Mexican, anti-Latino migration, right?
Yeah.
But also in off year, I mean, this is a 2006, so it's one of the, you know, the off years, but there's still congressional elections that are going on, right? There's
mm-hmm.
other gubernatorial elections that are going on, and it seems to work like, you know, almost like clockwork, right?
It's a
familiar trope, and it's one that politicians use because, mm-hmm. right? Let's be honest, it garners a strong response.
Yes.
From people that are more upset about people are really upset are about, you know, neoliberal policies that are having a detrimental effect on, you know, middle income and lower income America. But, you know, since politicians clearly don't have a response to that,
right.
you know, let's create, and that's what you're talking about in these chapters 3 and 4, this process of othering that allows you kind of, you know, mark a problem. Like, here's the problem, and this is what we have to do away with, right? So we can see it's visible, we can focus policy on this issue, and, you know, let's handle it this way.
Even though you have local politicians that cannot do anything
exactly.
to affect that,
right.
they will still use that in a way that garners, you know, elections, and so that they bring voters to the polls because it becomes a hot topic, right? What's going to get people's attention? One of the other things I talk about, especially in Chapter 3, is then how the word illegal becomes a way to safely talk about these populations, but then I argue is a racial epithet.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Because it goes from modifying somebody's status to then a noun, to describing that person as an illegal. And what that does, in effect, is dehumanizes them completely. Then they're no longer a human person. They're not even an illegal alien, which was the narrative in the 80s during Puppet 7 and the 90s. But they're now an illegal, and so therefore it completely strips any humanity from their experience. You can't see them through compassionate eyes. You can see them through the act. And so as such, and when I was doing research, is when people would use that term, their voice would change. They would get physically angry,
right,
and they would use it in a way that was a racial epithet that to me reminded me of research done on the N-word, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like it's one of those things that becomes a way that politicians can get away with using it, that nobody's like calling on it, but it's a subtle way, again, of how racism operates still in this country.
Right. Yeah. Your mention of how, you know, you said that in the book, how people's countenance would seemingly change, right? As soon as that, you know, the word illegal was mentioned, or something that kind of, you know, connected to, you know, an undocumented person, that you could see a visceral change in people. Their tone would change, their mannerisms would change, you know, and even people that were seemingly, you know, that would see themselves as progressive or liberal, right?
Right.
That they even bought into these, you know, racial tropes that were embedded within this language of legality.
Right. Right.
Well, you also point out in these two chapters how, you know, in this process of othering, what happens is there's kind of a metaphorical extension then of the borderlands and of the border itself to Middle America, mm-hmm. to where Latino populations, you know, become, you know, they feel like they are under threat, that they are under constant surveillance, that they have this risk and uncertainty of, you know, whether it's deportation, right? Because, you know, there's various proposals that are being tossed up, you know, in the national discourse as to what should be done. You know, if this legislation was to pass, how are we going to get rid of all these people, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all, of course, very familiar because we're dealing with all this again. There's then the issues also of microaggressions and then just flat out racism, which what we've been talking about a bit. So the border gets extended in this metaphorical sense, you know, through this national discourse and focus on legality and immigration policy. So let's shift now to talk to, now how did Latinos then deal with this? Let's talk more of these examples of ethnic belonging. How did they form community, both earlier prior to this, right? Prior to this anti-immigrant hysteria that set the foundation for then how they would respond more assertive, you know, in an assertive and you know, I don't want to use, pride is not the word I'm looking for. It's a more appropriative, defensive kind of way, right?
Right.
You know, taking pride in their ethnicity and claiming space is eventually where we're going, where the book, the narrative takes us.
Cool. Yeah, so you mentioned border theory, which I think is important here to talk about that second aspect that you're talking about, because and Anzaldúa was obviously a influence in my life as an undergraduate and certainly now even as a faculty member. But Anzaldúa talks about the borderlands as, you know, where the place where the first world grates against the third or the third world and bleeds.
Right.
And I use that metaphor later, right, to talk about even Indiana, and it's no longer the first and the third world. It's when two worlds create against each other and bleed, in the sense that you have communities coming together, and sometimes that coming together creates conflict, and there's issues and there's problems, and people can't see each other within the same space, and there's, you know, either or us versus them mentalities. Now, for Anzaldúa, the borderlands was also a place of creative opportunity, right? Where people can exist in both spaces and navigate those worlds cohesively. And so that's where I went with ethnic belonging, is that here's a way in which people navigated their belonging, not through notions of assimilation, but through notions of I can assert an ethnic identity. I can have ties back to Mexico.
Right.
I can go back to Puerto Rico during the holidays and also live in the U.S. And those two aren't oppositional.
Right, right.
And so I mentioned, for instance, one of the examples of ethnic belonging was at, you know, a baseball game where a team from Mexico had come up to do a competition, and the team was from Juarez, and I don't think anyone in the town at that point was from Juarez. So they had no actual connection to the families there. But all the, you know, as many Mexicanos that could show up went to the game, and during the national anthem for Mexico, they stood up and they raised their hand in the way that Mexico does, with, you know, your palm facing down.
Right.
And they bolted out that song, and it was beautiful, because here you have a space in Indiana that's a majority white space, and here you have Mexicanos standing up and asserting their right to sing that song. And that doesn't mean they're terrorists, or it doesn't mean that they're anti-America.
Right.
It just means this is part of our ethnic identity. And even Mexican Americans stood up. They might not have known the words, but they stood up with their brethren. And so that becomes an important point of kind of establishing then a right to be here, to assert a space, to not be ashamed of our ethnicity. And then when it came time to it, to protest or march on behalf of that later.
Right, You know, it reminds me of when the Mexican national team plays at the Rose Bowl. When they do, it's as if the fans for the Mexican national team almost, I think at times, clearly outnumber those that are going for the U.S. Men's national team. Even one of my foreign advisors kind of wrote a paper on this, where it started this as an example of that. But that's what it brings to, you know, images, right? Then and as you say, it's, you know, it's an assertion of, you know, ethnic pride that that in the media discourse and the politicized, you know, discourse becomes somehow interpreted as un-American. But it's just ludicrous when you really think about it. I mean, when you think of the ethnic white identity, there's nothing anti-American about being Irish-American, being German-American, whatever, what else, Italian-American. There's communities, you know, throughout the country that take a lot of pride in. I mean, there's Little Italy's all over the country. I mean, I grew up in San Diego, and there's a very small Little Italy there, but, there's a strong sense of ethnic pride and even, you know, municipal pride around that space that somehow is, to me, stood out as a space of, you know, that was somehow interpreted as different from the ethnic Mexican barrio Logan, which is just like not even, you know, just a few blocks away from it, you know, and it's just so ironic to me, then how, you know, I mean, as a historian, I've of course studied this and seen the cyclical nature, but it still never ceases to baffle my mind how, you know, this is discussed in this and it's discussed through this lens of assimilation, right? That's the issue, right? These people, because they're singing a song and they're waving another flag, somehow they are not assimilating, and thereby they are a threat. The exact opposite is the case, right? The actual opposite is that our economy would fail, not from the absence of cheap labor. That's not what I'm saying, but from the lack of the what these people generate as far as our national economy. Right. I mean, their consumption, habits and patterns. I don't want to reduce everything to this kind of market analysis, but all of that is lost, right? All of these contributions, because that's typically how it's viewed, is, you know, under these type of market figures, right? This is what Latinos cost X and they produce Y, right? And those are always, you know, vastly distorted, but again, it's all through this lens of assimilation and not assimilating in a particular way that is ethnic white is a threat somehow. You know, even though now we are dealing with over a century of Mexican migration to, you know, just, and let's forget the pack, you know, let's forget the Mexican past of, you know, the southwestern portion of this country, or even its indigenous past and all that stuff. But let's just, you know, say, okay, let's pick up from the last 100 years, right? You know, the country's still here, you know, right? People are, you know, merging, and they're crafting, you know, third spaces, as you bring up in the book, and hybrid type cultures and practices that, when we really look back, it's not, you know, the country's not going anywhere, right? I mean, it's not going to bring an end, so to speak, of the nation or ruin the nation. But in these highly charged debates, as you point out in chapters 3 and 4, it's that perception is that's what's going to happen. You know, somehow there.
Yeah, it's not the ethnic identity itself or the ethnic belonging that's a problem. It's the way that we perceive the ethnic identity of this particular population that becomes a problem.
Right.
So that people, one of the letters to the editor friends is like, they speak Spanish, and, you know, there's no countries that exist with multiple languages that possibly can, be good in the end. And I think they cite France as an example. Mm-hmm. And what I say back to that letter to the editor is, it's not the fact that there's multiple languages existing in one space that's the problem. It's the way that people see that's the problem. And it's our negative attention to this particular ethnic identity. As you mentioned, right, you have St. Patrick's Day, everybody's Irish, and the Irish flag comes out, and there's Irish ditty song. And there's no issues with that. And so I think that it's definitely an issue that we have to work through, that it's not a challenge. And as you mentioned, right, we've had Mexican populations in parts of the country for over 100 years now. And they haven't caused the downturn of an entire population. In fact, I would argue that in places like Arizona, where I live now, it was SB 1070, which is the local version of of right. anti-immigration laws. It was that law that caused an even higher economic downturn when we faced the economic downturns of 2010, 2011, because you had people flee.
Right.
And that with their fleeing, you know, housing issues became an issue because, you know, houses lay abandoned, renting lay abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
They were no longer spending money in the community. And as you said, we shouldn't just create this notion of Latinos bringing marketability. But, you know, it's also it's the opposite is true, that instead of ruining a community, it's their leaving that ruins the community,
right.
I would argue.
Right. Well, and then all the other backlash, you know, the disinvestment, you know, from corporations
exactly.
and states refusing to do business, you know, as a result of that policy. Yeah, indeed. I want to talk about also, because we're still on this issue of ethnic belonging, I think the sports example, it's a great one. A big theme of the book, though, is, you know, the establishment of ethnic belonging through religious community, and particularly, you know, both the interactions of women within the formation of religious community and religious institutions, and how that connected with this building notions of ethnic belonging and taking, you know, a sense of, you know, pride and place within Central Indiana. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So along with the marches, obviously, become a very public display of civic engagement. What I say is that there's other public displays of ethnic belonging that can just as importantly display a right to belong. And so I talked about the Easter procession that they have there. It's yearly. It's an annual event now. But it's a very, very public display of Latino ethnic identity through a religious perspective. And so they have an Easter pageant of sorts that's outside. And I argue that, you know, having this Easter pageant during Easter, during the height of the anti-immigration debate, was, even if not purposeful, an important moment to discuss the right to belong, even if ethnically, mm-hmm. in a public space. And so I was looking at the importance of those kind of religious moments, and what does religion and faith have, what's the impact of it with communities when they first arrive? Like, how are they dependent on these institutions? How do the institutions help them or hinder them in some cases? And what I start noticing within a gender perspective is the female networks were crucial, especially because men were often, when they first arrived, the ones to go to work. And so females would arrive and have nobody and feel completely isolated. And this definitely had an impact on their psyche in terms of kind of their survival and feeling completely depressed in the space, oftentimes during winter, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where they were physically inside and couldn't get out and didn't know anybody in their neighborhood. And so female social networks in the church became ways in which their friendships grew. And whether it was the Catholic Church or, and the other example I used with Latina Mormons,
mm-hmm.
The sisterhood or the comadrazgo in Catholics becomes a way in which they build their, what we call in anthropology, fictive kin. They didn't have physical sisters in the neighborhood because often they were the only families that moved there first. Or their aunts or their mothers were still in other parts of, you know, California or Mexico. And so the sisterhood for Mormons or the comadrazgo for Catholics becomes the way in which these women found each other and helped each other survive, and I think still do, by just continuously having a friendship and a network of people to go to when you need something. So that was definitely critically important for me for ethnic belonging, because that establishes people's sense of community.
Right.
And that they have an invested effort to be there, and they're no longer just kind of migrants that are floating in different spaces, but now they, you know, are buying houses, they're settling in, and they're raising the next generation, and they also have this other network of friends that make it home.
Mm-hmm.
And that means something when that home is being taken away from you, where the political rhetoric is saying, no, it's not your home. Then you're willing to fight for it.
Certainly, no. I really appreciated these examples because it became very concrete for me, right? In when one reads, you know, when you read a term, a concept, you know, like, you know, ethnic belonging, it seems so abstract. But what you really do is a great job of, you know, showing how this actually works out on the ground through people's interactions and how, you know, just everyday actions of either, you know, going shopping or going to a baseball game, or a lot of this is, you know, through religion and ethno-religious practice, how these, you know, fictive kinships are established and rooted in, and how that created such a sense of strength for these people, particularly during, you know, this time in 2006, 2005 and 2006, yeah. Right, where their presence is being, again, you know, perceived as both a threat and they're seemingly perceived as undesirable, but yet within their interactions amongst each other, you know, they are providing, you know, that sense of bond and community that helps them to overcome that. And as you say, you know, really start to envision themselves as belonging in this place.
Right. Well, and to tell you the truth, I mean, I started off the interview by talking about how the research I do is often kind of trying to capture the experiences that I know from a familiar perspective from my family.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was reading, when I was doing graduate work and reading the existing research on, let's see, Latino cultural citizenship and notions of civic engagement and participatory politics, the thread is often to look at community organizations, which is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we need to start looking at community organizations and acknowledging what services they do. But behind the back of my head, I kept thinking of my parents and all my relatives, my tías and tíos and uncles and cousins and everywhere, who honestly, no one in my family has ever participated in a community organization.
Right.
They definitely reap the benefits, I will say that, right, obviously. But they never had the time because they worked so hard.
Yes.
Because they were working, you know, 60 hours a week, and the only time we did have was Sunday to go to church.
Mm-hmm.
And so that became, you know, Sunday church time, my carne asada. That was our, you know, life beyond work. And so I kept thinking, you know, what about all these other things that still build community?
Mm-hmm.
And what about all those people that don't have access to or time to commit to a community organization? They're still participating in some way with their community. We just have to be able to acknowledge it. And we can't just ignore them as, well, they're not the population we're looking at, because they're just as important to the community as the community organization.
You know, exactly. And it's a theme and an issue that comes up in my work. You know, as a historian, that's exactly what I'm looking for. I mean, I study ethnic organizations and particularly political organizations, but my interest is always, right, where do they come from, right? What's what are the generative, you know, social interactions that eventually cause these people to build the bonds that then translate into politics? And it's exactly what you're talking about, which for a historian, it's really hard for us to find it, because a lot of times people don't leave that record, right? They don't leave these wonderful journals of what they did on Sunday or what they do when they come home from work. And mostly it's hard enough for us to find just, you know, the documents, or even established oral histories that talk about the organizational aspect of it. Nonetheless, you know, just the lived experience, which I think is such a great, aspect of anthropological work and ethnographic work, is that's what you get to do, right? You get to go into these communities and pull from document and pull from these lived experiences, and be able to do so in a very rich type of way that it really makes me envious, is what I'm saying.
I think that, I mean, I, as I said, I'm a historian sort of by training as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think that that's where, obviously, you can always get this with archives, and depending on how back you go, right, you can always do oral histories.
Mm-hmm.
Because that could be a space in which you know, obviously when we talk about oral histories with community organizations, you want to talk about the way the community organization was created and its, you know, its successes and its issues. But talking about, as you mentioned, like other things that happened to build that sense of community that then would result in a community organization, I think can be done in oral history.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of
exactly.
Be willing to go outside the box. And so when I asked one individual about a particular community organization that had formed and is still there, you know, where did it begin? I didn't just ask her about the organization's history, but I asked her about her history.
Right.
You know, what was life like for you when you first arrived? And
mm-hmm.
how did you end up getting involved with this community organization? And then we just went back in time and really started getting at those details. And she says, ultimately, it was being a mom and being lonely and having mm-hmm. to go to... For what's a for not kindergarten, first steps, no.
Preschool or Head Start?
It's like preschool.
Uh-huh.
And so she would go to these kind of preschool things with her child, and then the mother started coordinating and kind of being like, let's get together for coffee when the kids
exactly.
are at school or whatever.
Exactly.
And then they would get together, and then they found there was an issue, and we got to do something about the issue, but that took time.
It's, yeah, yeah.
But without those initial coffee meetings or just getting together yeah. as mothers, that organization may not have formed.
Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
No, that's great. And where we are running out of time, I wanted to talk about two other things really quickly because I'm really conscious of your time. So first, I want you to bring us forward, right? It's been about 10 years since both the Sensen Brenner bill and the mobilizations that spurred from it. So if you would first talk about that, and then we'll close with you talking about what you're working on now. But tell
sure.
us, kind of bring
so,
us forward the next 10 years. What's going on in Central Indiana right now with these communities?
Sure. Well, unfortunately, Central Indiana, or Indiana in general, followed the path of the place I'm living at now, which is Arizona, and it created its own state-based legislation that was supposed to deal with the undocumented community from a state level.
Mm-hmm.
And so, just like you mentioned earlier, when there's particular political election seasons, you have politicians rally, and they pass legislation because they think that their electorate's going to be happy. And so as a result, Indiana has a pretty strict state-wide bill that kind of mimics that of Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And I talk about this in the conclusion because I think it was important to realize that, you know, it's not ended, right? The
right.
issues haven't ended, obviously.
Right.
Some communities have, some individuals, I did follow-up interviews after 2006. I went back about 3 more times. And each time I would go, I'd hear about another family that left. And so, but they're not leaving to go to Mexico, point.
Yeah.
I have to make that point. They're going to other states. And so, you know, folks aren't what Romney called it, self-deportation. They're not self-deporting.
Yeah, they're not self-deporting.
No, they're going to other states or their cities in which they can find sanctuary, and not because they're sanctuary cities, but because they can live without being completely policed all the time.
Right.
And that, as we mentioned earlier, is taking issues or taking
takes a toll, right?
It takes a toll on the community that they're leaving, right?
Right.
They're taking with them their bodies, but also what they contribute to that community.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have left, but other people have stayed and have said, no, I'm not leaving. I'm
right.
staying here. And this is, again, this is my home, and you have no right to legislate me out.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I've done some follow-up interviews, people have continued organizing from a smaller level, but they also, you know, face walls sometimes. And so you had individuals who were taking part of the immigration rally in Indianapolis who later continue to go down to Indianapolis and have one-on-one meetings with their legislators. I mean, you can't get more civic engagement than that.
Right.
And try to really rally and position the importance of not doing an Arizona-style bill. The bill shifted and changed its wording to kind of match some of the issues. So some individuals felt like the bill was gone, but in fact, it's still on the record.
Hmm.
And as a result, depending on where you are in Indiana, you're going to get caught up in the system. And so what I compare it to sundown towns,
mm-hmm.
which was in Indiana, against black communities as
right.
well as other parts of the U.S., where, you know, you better not be caught with the sundown or else your body will be in danger
right.
at the time if you were black. But now I'm saying now it's if you're brown.
Right.
People know certain areas of Indiana that are okay because they're not going to police you. And they also know where to avoid.
Right.
And that's really disheartening
mm-hmm.
because it's saying that some people are taking liberties, shall we say, with the bill and being really restrictive. And other communities are like, you know, we realize that the Latino communities here are not our enemies. And we can utilize their efforts better if we don't target them this way.
Right.
And so as a result, depending on where you live, depending on where you drive, you might get caught up in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem. That's not equality in this country.
Right. Yeah, no, it speaks completely in the face of the 14th Amendment, you know, and it's equal protection provisions and whatnot. So,
right. Well, because people can take it to themselves as to how to disseminate this law.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, thank you for bringing us up to the present with it. Now, tell us, what is it you're working on now? I know you have another project.
Right. Yeah, so I kind of inspired by the Latino community that I experienced, that I interviewed in Indiana, the Mormon community in Indiana, definitely had a lasting impact on me. So that when I moved to Gilbert, Arizona, when I first got my job here at ASU, it was during the time of Russell Pierce's recall. And if the audience will remember, Russell Pierce was the author of SB 1070, which is Arizona's state-based law. And it was daunting but inspiring to see the recall, right?
Yes,
because people did rally and recall him from office, and that was wonderful to see. And what I started remembering from Indiana was that there was a large Latino population there that were Mormon. Well, not large. It was growing. Mm-hmm. That were Mormon, and they had positive interactions with their white Mormon brethren. And so I thought that was interesting here in Arizona because Russell Pierce himself was Mormon. And in fact, at one point even said that he had the Mormon church's backing, which he never did. But he argued that he did. And so therefore, I thought that was interesting. And I thought, well, I'm in Arizona. I wonder if there's a Latino Mormon population here, thinking it would be like the size of Indiana. No, I was wrong. It was huge. and it's not just a large Mormon population. So in Indiana, there was a branch. It was just a tiny community made up of maybe 10 families total on a good day. And here you have entire wards. I want to say the last I saw, Phoenix was serving 30 wards of Spanish-speaking members.
Wow.
And wards are much bigger than just 10 families, obviously.
Yeah, it's like a whole congregation, hundreds of people.
It's an entire congregation, exactly. Yeah. So if you think about that, there's 30 Spanish-speaking congregations in Phoenix alone.
Wow.
There were more before Russell Pierce with SB 1070. So when I came to Arizona, I was interested in the Latino Mormon experience. I'm like, how are they experiencing Russell Pierce?
Yeah.
What is the impact on them? And I did some history, and I found out that not only is there a large population here, but then it's historical. So the Latino Mormon population in Mesa, which is where I'm doing most of my research in, has been here since 1918. So we're talking almost a century of existing Spanish-speaking Mormons in Mesa, Arizona, in the same district that Russell Pierce comes out of. So in a sense, that's what the new project is looking at the Latino experience in the LDS Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Looking at the history of Mesa is important because Mesa also has it was at one point the only temple in Arizona. Now there's more. But it's the first temple in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that had Spanish services, Spanish endowment for a long time.
Wow.
So it becomes a center for Spanish-speaking Mormons. Spanish-speaking Mormons from Utah even make the migration to Mesa to go to temple here.
Gotcha. Right.
And following on my research, I look at ethnic belonging in the church. How are Spanish-speaking Mormons blending their ethnicity and faith? And then I'm certainly looking at gender and the role of the sisterhood, going off of the chapter in the book, the sisterhood of Latina saints. How does it compare to comadrazgo in the Catholic tradition? And how is it important, especially in a state like Arizona, when these communities are still being policed and may not feel so safe necessarily? So it's on Latinos in the LDS Church, and it's still ongoing. I'm still collecting research, grant writing now, so I can try to get some more funding to do some more research and collect some oral histories as well as ethnographic data.
Great. I mean, that is much needed research. As you say, you know, and it's not just within the Mormon church, it's within many Protestant churches. I mean, the existence of Latinos in, Christian religious populations and congregations outside of Catholicism is really understudied, there's a lot of work that needs to be done on that, and so that sounds fascinating. I can't wait to read your work that comes out of this project.
Yeah, it's going to be a while in the making, but I'm excited to have it come out soon.
great. Well, thanks again for coming on and to New Books in Latino Studies and discussing Latino Heartland. We encourage our readers to, pick up the book and to read it and discuss with our communities. It's so timely. I chuckled so many times as I was reading, the issues of, the narratives and the discourse that was going on. And I was thinking, man, you could just change the date, to 2015, 2016. It's very similar. So.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and I do hope that readers would take it. And it's not, even though it's definitely in the Midwest, I think that what I try to do is bring attention to this particular locale, but it can translate to other communities certainly as well.
Definitely. Thanks. Definitely. Well, thanks again, Suhei.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with Suhei Vega, author of Latino Heartland, of Borders and Belonging in the Midwest, published by New York University Press in 2015. I encourage you to grab a copy of Dr. Vega's book, and you may do so by following the link to Amazon on our New Books in Latino Studies page. Also, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast, which you may do through iTunes or Stitcher, or connect with us via Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email to newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com.